Hello, and welcome to Bardcast, Shakespeare Podcast. I'm Carson.
And I'm Jeff.
And today we're talking about The Taming of the Shrew. And Taming of the Shrew is a comedy.
Well, sort of.
In terms of the Shakespeare production.
Yeah.
Everything turns out happily in terms of Shakespeare's time.
And depending on the interpretation of the play as it's performed.
Right. There's a large issue with this play about our modern take on it versus the take that Shakespeare's people would have had at the time, and it relates to gender stuff, and we'll get to that later, but essentially, this was supposed to be a happy play, regardless of how we feel about it now.
Well, and even the way it's presented now can make it a happy play.
Right. So, the source material of this play is a highly debated thing. We're not going to get too into it, but basically there is kind of a general source that is in the that would have been in the culture of Shakespeare's time.
Mm-hmm. Of a man marrying a very strong-willed woman.
Right, and taming her by using systematic abuse. There's also a source for the induction of the play, the first bit of the play where...
That's a weird bit, too.
Where a person falls asleep drunk and is convinced that he is a lord, and they put on another play for him.
Mm-hmm.
So there is another play during Shakespeare's time called The Taming of a Shrew.
Yeah, and there's a lot of debate about what that could be, whether it's a precursor or a successor, or if it's just like someone made a bad copy of it.
Right. In science, when we see that two things happen at the same time, there are basically four different options. One, A caused B. 2, B caused A. 3, they were both caused by the same thing. Or 4, they were both caused by different things and just happened to happen at the same time.
Yeah, that one's probably unlikely in this case.
Right. In this case, most people nowadays think that Shakespeare wrote Taming of the Shrew first, and A Shrew is kind of based on it in some way. And there are a bunch of little details. The thing that I find most interesting is two parts. One, there are details in Taming of a Shrew that don't make as much sense as they do in Shakespeare's version, so presumably those would have been stolen.
Mm-hmm.
And even though The Taming of a Shrew is set in Athens, the main woman in the play is still named Kate.
Which is not exactly a Greek name.
Exactly. Those two things do lean in that direction. So it seems like, at least nowadays, people are agreed that either Taming of a Shrew is based on Shakespeare's, or it is in some way inspired by the same thing, but it's almost certainly not the source for Shakespeare's play.
Mm-hmm. Unless it was just a ridiculously convoluted series of events, basically.
Right. Unfortunately,
which Shakespeare scholars tend to believe in.
Unfortunately, we don't actually seem to have the final version of The Taming of the Shrew. There are a few odd things about our play that mean that we probably don't have a final draft of the play, even in our official folio version. This play was only published in the first folio, and all additional copies are just amendments and copies of this original folio.
Which means, like, they probably screwed it up a little bit, because there are clear things where it's just like an entire plot line kind of goes unresolved with the induction and stuff like that.
Yeah, which we'll get to in just a moment. The induction. This is a very odd stage theater mechanic thing.
Basically, they're setting up like a framework for the play, so there's these characters and they're watching the play as characters, almost.
Mm-hmm. In the induction, Christopher Sly is this drunken, kind of worthless guy who is in a lot of debt and is mad and kind of a fighter.
Mm.
And these lords find him lying unconscious and say, well, if we pretend he's a lord, like, we put him in a fancy bed, we pretend that we're his servants, and we say that you've been under this delusion for years and years, that you've been unconscious and dreaming this life that you've been living, but you're actually a lord, and here is your wife, here are your servants, what fancy thing would you like to eat, etc. And in this story, the characters go to see the play, The Taming of the Shrew.
Yeah.
So the actual title play, the main play, is a play within the play.
Exactly.
And our Christopher Sly and his attendants are watching the play throughout.
Mm-hmm.
This is presumably from the balcony that Shakespeare's theater had.
I don't know if he would have had enough actors to have people up there acting that all the time during the play, too.
Right, it does seem very odd. This is the part that we talked about it not making a whole lot of sense. They go up there. At the end of Act 1, Scene 3, Christopher Sly asks, oh, is it done? Basically.
Mm-hmm.
As though, even though it had obviously just begun, he's so stupid that he thinks that it's over. And they say, no, there's actually quite a bit to go. And he says, oh, it's a very excellent piece of work. Would it were done. And that's the last thing. There's a stage direction that says, they sit and mark. As to say, mm-hmm. they sit and watch the play and talk about it. But that is the end of their participation in the play.
Yeah. Though there is a tacked-on bit at the end that is not necessarily from Shakespeare's version.
Right. In The Taming of a Shrew, there is a resolution to this story, and some people like to tie it together at the end by either taking something from A Shrew or just kind of adding their own thing.
Helps it make a little more sense.
Right, because otherwise they're just sitting and talking there for four acts and doing nothing, and there's no resolution whatsoever.
It actually makes more sense to drop Sly entirely.
Right, with if you just had the first folio, I would drop Christopher Sly. I know it's charming and it's fun, but there's no resolution to that story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, one interesting thing about that is a lot of the people in the induction are apparently, when Christopher Sly is talking about, but what about these people I know? He's referring to people Shakespeare like might have known around Stratford itself.
Right, that would have been relatively public people. He talks about that he owes money to this woman and she would have been
an innkeeper, I think.
Exactly. So that's kind of an interesting detail, kind of throwing a shout-out to his homies.
Especially since this might actually have been one of his first plays.
An early one, yeah. An odd contrivance. Certainly not as cool as Hamlet's play within a play, but a neat little idea there. And it's perfectly legitimate, the induction, as theater. There's some good dialogue. When Christopher Sly meets his wife, who is actually a man dressed as a woman, he says, well, come to bed then. Immediately. Having decided that he might as well live up the life as a lord. So yeah, there's some nice stuff in there, but there's absolutely no resolution, so it's frustrating.
It would have been a much more interesting play, just if they kept following his life as a fake lord.
That would have been a good play too, yeah. So let's talk about the real play, The Taming of the Shrew.
Okay.
So there are two plots in this which are relatively connected. They don't interact a lot, but they are connected.
Yeah.
Basically, they're about two different women, sisters.
Katharina and Bianca.
Right. Bianca is this beautiful, beloved, everyone thinks that she's great.
Everybody wants to marry her.
Right. Woman. And Katharina is
her older sister, who is mean to people. She throws things, she yells, and she does not want to be courted.
Right, and she is the shrew.
Mm-hmm.
Someone once asked, why is she a shrew? Which I think is a legitimate question, and I think it shows...
When you say, why is she a... do you mean, what does she do that makes her a shrew, or why did Shakespeare write her as a shrew? Or what in her life has turned her into this person?
I meant as a character point. Like, what in her life has made her into this kind of angry, resentful woman?
Mm.
And I think that you can actually kind of gather it from the dialogue that she thinks that her other sister gets all the precedence, and she resents being treated like the way that women were treated at the time. I think that nowadays when she says stuff like, oh, you give me permission to stay here, well, I guess I might leave then because I'm not a prisoner, right? Like, that sort of thing seems perfectly reasonable to us, that someone would say that sort of thing, because I'd be incredibly resentful of the way they treat women at the time. It's just, at the time of Shakespeare, it was more ordinary for women to be treated as property. Talking about Bianca, as we said, she's the one that everyone wants to marry.
Mm-hmm. But her father won't let anyone marry her until her older sister, Catherine, is married.
Right. So there's this problem of, we have to find someone to marry Catherine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Petruchio, the protagonist of the story, shows up and essentially says, I will marry anyone for money. And you think, okay, so this is going to be a contrast between these two people. But in fact, it is a relentless siege of torture, essentially, in any legal sense, where he deprives her and forces her to march until she is reduced to less of a person who does not object to the treatment she receives.
Mm-hmm.
So, This play is set in Italy, specifically the city of Padua. Yet again, Shakespeare doesn't seem to know much about Italy. He mentions some stuff that would have been known from a recent document about Italy, like that it's the nursery of arts, is a direct quote from something that he would have been able to read at the time. So, yet again, we don't think that Shakespeare has been to Italy, just that Italy is a popular place at the time.
Yeah. All plays are set in Italy, unless they're about England.
Almost. So, in Bianca's plot, we've got the kind of male protagonist of Lucentio.
He is the young, hot guy who's in town.
When he comes to the city, he's first looking to simply study.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to learn how to be virtuous and all the academics and stuff. But when he sees Bianca, he is converted into someone looking for a wife. And because of all the shenanigans going on, he decides that the best thing to do is to be one of the tutors of Bianca.
Yeah, hoping that by getting close to her, she'll fall in love with him.
Mm-hmm. And so he and Tranio, his servant, switch. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of people switching their roles in this play. Sly becomes a lord, Tranio becomes a lord, Lucentio becomes a servant. So we've also got the other suitors.
Hortensio, who is another younger guy, or becomes one of the tutors, and Gremio, who is an older guy but who is wealthy.
Right. We get the impression that Gremio isn't automatically eliminated from the competition because he is old. I think that this is because the daughter doesn't necessarily get to decide.
Right.
Who she marries. This particular father of Bianca does say you should win Catherine's heart, but it isn't a legal prerequisite.
Mm-hmm. And later on, he specifically says that she'll go to whoever gives him a better dowry or whatever.
Mm-hmm. That Bianca doesn't get to make up her mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the basic characters of Bianca's plot. For Katharina,
there is her.
Yeah.
There's Petruchio and Petruchio's servant, Grumio.
And Petruchio has a bunch of minor servants.
They don't really matter.
Yeah, they're not significant.
And a few other people coming in and out of the play, but we can get to them as they come up on.
Right, so let's talk about the plot in more detail.
Okay.
Act 1, which is technically scene 3 because we've skipped the induction, is the introduction of the kind of Lucentio thing, mainly.
Mm-hmm. He comes into town, is like, I'm here to study. And then he sees all the characters who already live in Padua interacting. Is like, wow, who's that cute girl?
Right. He comes upon the scene where the father explains, to marry my daughter, you must first get my other daughter married, and immediately falls in love.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and he also says, and if you know any good tutors, please give me a recommendation.
Right. As always, Shakespeare manages to get some action in with his explaining what's going on, so we've got... It's not entirely boring to see Shakespeare explain who these people are and what they're doing.
Gremio and Hortensio begin plotting to find tutors for Bianca, and they agree to that they're going to find a husband for Kate.
Right. They are rivals for Bianca, but they realize that they are allies in trying to get Catherine married.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the interesting thing about the relationship between Lucio and Tranio is that it's Tranio that suggests that they switch places. He essentially thinks to himself, well, I would like to live it up as a lord for a while, and if this works for him, that's perfect.
Mm-hmm. One thing about this play is that it doesn't have as much of a fool character like a lot of his comedies do.
Right. Petruchio's servant has some foolish moments, but he is not as foolish as a foolish fool.
Yeah, he doesn't have, like, the witty banter or anything like that as much.
Just a little bit.
In the next scene, Petruchio shows up with Grumio. It turns out Petruchio is an old friend of Hortensio's. And basically, Hortensio convinces him that he should go after Kate, because he'll get paid.
Yeah, they do warn him thoroughly that Kate, as a woman that we would see as perfectly ordinary today...
Well, she is a little crazy.
We can go into that later.
Mm-hmm.
She is seen as monstrously unmanageable in her time.
Hortensio says that he's going to disguise himself as a tutor, and Lucentio, as a tutor, is hired by Gremio to go in as well.
Right, so all of the tutors are actually secretly suitors trying mm-hmm. to marry Bianca. Mm-hmm.
And Hortensio and Gremio are both paying Petruchio to woo Kate.
Everyone asks Petruchio, are you so brave to do this? And we get kind of some character stuff. It turns out that Petruchio is a military man. Think you not a little din can daunt mine ears? Have I not in my time heard lions roar? Have I not heard the sea puffed up with winds, rage like an angry boar chafed with sweat? Have I not heard great ordnance in the field and heaven's artillery thunder in the skies? Have I not in pitched battle heard loud larums, neighing steeds and trumpets clang? And do you tell me of a woman's tongue that gives not half so great a blow to hear as will a chestnut in a farmer's fire? Tush, tush, fear boys with bugs. He very much sees this as minor compared to his previous fighting life.
Mm-hmm.
We go to Act 2.
And there Catherine has tied up Bianca and is trying to get her to admit that she loves Hortensio or Gremio.
Right, this is probably the worst thing that Catherine does. She actually ties up her sister just to bother her, as far as we can tell.
And then beats her when she refuses to commit to either one.
She does physically strike Bianca. We don't know the details because it simply says, strikes her.
Yeah.
So that comes down to how much you want to perform that.
Mm-hmm.
This is the bit about Catherine explaining why she is as she is.
Ah, yeah.
Baptista orders...
Baptista is the father, by the way.
Right, Baptista the father orders Bianca to get out and is kind of outraged by this abuse of his daughter. And Catherine says, what, will you not suffer me? Nay, now I see she is your treasure. She must have a husband. I must dance barefoot on her wedding day. And for your love to her, lead apes in hell. Talk not of me. I will go sit and weep till I can find occasion of revenge. So she very much resents the status that her sister has. In particular, dancing barefoot on the wedding day is apparently a good luck charm, that if you dance barefoot at someone else's wedding, you will be married next, as it were.
Yeah. So then a bunch of people come in, Gremio, Lucentio, Petruchio, Hortensio, Tranio, everyone, basically.
Right. This is Petruchio's big introduction to the family. Saying the opposite of what we would have expected, he comes in and says that he has heard of Kate's beauty in her wit, her affability and bashful modesty, her wondrous qualities and mild behavior, and that he very much desires to marry her. He doesn't introduce himself as someone looking for money.
Mm-hmm. And then Baptiste quickly agrees, okay, you want her, you can have her, basically.
If you win her heart.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Hortensio and Lucentio have gone off to tutor the daughters.
Right, we get a funny piece when Hortensio, who is the music tutor, Lucentio is our language tutor, Hortensio returns with a broken lute.
That was Katharina hit him over the head with it.
Right. She very much resented her lessons. Thou canst not break her to the lute. Why no, for she hath broke the lute to me. I did but tell her she mistook her frets and bowed her hand to teach her fingering, when with a most impatient devilish spirit, frets call you these, quoth she, I'll fume with them. And with that word she stroked me on the head, and through the instrument my pate made way. So his head went through the thing.
Yes, it's a very amusing image on stage.
Mm-hmm. So right before Petruchio meets Catherine, he's alone on the stage, and he says that he will do something unexpected. He will pretend that everything she does is nice to him.
Mm-hmm.
So when she rails, that is, shouts or complains, I'll tell her plain she sings as sweetly as a nightingale. When she frown, I'll say she look as clear as morning roses newly washed with dew. Say she be mute and will not speak a word, then I'll commend her volubility, and say that she uttereth piercing eloquence.
And this kind of foreshadows some of the horrible stuff he's going to do later.
Right. This is probably Catherine and Petruchio's best scene, where they're kind of meeting as equals. She sees that she has every right to yell at him, and he is very much the purposeful man who will control her. We get some rather lewd banter. Catherine's been comparing him to a buzzard, which is something that buzzes, in addition to what we think of as a buzzard, and saying that his speech is meaningless. He says that she's being waspish. She says, if I be waspish, best beware my sting. He says he could pluck out the sting. She says, if the fool could find it where it lies.
Who knows not where a wasp does wear its his sting? In his tail?
In his tongue.
Whose tongue?
Yours, if you will talk of tails, and so farewell.
What, with my tongue in your tail? Nay, come again, good Kate. I am a gentleman.
So Petruchio does go along with his plan. I find you passing gentle. 'Twas told me you were rough and coy and sullen, and now I find report a very liar. For thou art pleasant, gamesome, passing courteous, but slow in speech, yet sweet as springtime flowers. Thou canst not frown, thou canst not look askance, nor bite the lip as angry wenches will. nor hast thou pleasure to be cross in talk, but thou with mildness entertain'st thy wooers, with gentle conference, soft and affable. Why does the world report that Kate doth limp? O slanderous world, Kate, like the hazel twig, is straight and slender, and brown in hue as hazelnuts and sweeter than the kernels. Oh, let me see thee walk, thou dost not halt. The rest of the family shows up, and Petruchio just lies outright and says, we have agreed to marry, but she will act like she does not like me until we are married.
Mm-hmm. Then Beppe is like, all right, wedding on Sunday.
Yeah, it sounds like you did it, buddy.
And then he tells that the men who are competing for Bianca's hand, that whoever can offer the best dowry can marry her.
Right, which is rather cynical, but he did have to spend 20,000 ducats to get rid of Katharina, so I guess he does need some more money.
Mm-hmm. And then fake Lucentio wins the auction by basically claiming he has a bunch of stuff that he doesn't actually have.
Is that actually made clear?
His
father is wealthy. I don't think we ever really learn whether all of his stuff is real or not.
True. But
it does seem like he's going on and on, right?
Every time Grammy offers something, he says he just one-ups him.
Ah, yes. We do get the impression that maybe he's exaggerating when he says that he can offer twice as much, whatever thou offerest next.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter what you say, I will give twice as much.
Mm-hmm. And Baptista agrees with him but says that he won't confirm the deal until his father comes along and approves it. Lucentio's father, that is.
Right, because if his father doesn't die, then he won't inherit this stuff and won't be able to give it to Bianca. So he wants to have a guarantee that Bianca will receive this wealth.
Right.
And that brings us to Act 3, which has the two tutors both trying to court Bianca. Lucentio is winning it, definitely.
Yeah.
Hortensio, the music tutor, is continuously told to go away, your music is out of tune. And Lucentio, under pretending that he's giving a grammar, as though he's translating his words, says, hic ibat, as I told you before, simio, I am Lucentio, hic est, son unto Vincentio of Pisa, and so on, saying, as though he was translating his words, that I wish to marry you.
Yeah, he basically gives her the whole deal about himself in there.
Mm-hmm. And she rather charmingly responds, as though she was translating her words, I know you not, I trust you not. Take heed, he hear us not. Despair not.
Mm-hmm. Basically so, saying, I don't know you well enough yet, but, you know, let's talk about this for a while.
Mm-hmm. I do appreciate this play for the fact that it is one of the rare occasions where people do not instantly fall in love.
Yeah.
For both Kate and Bianca, neither of them just look at them and fall in love, although it does happen to Lucentio.
Mm-hmm.
Bianca must be stunningly good-looking in this.
Well, or charming or whatever. I mean,
she must be a presence on the stage. I think that we, to be convinced by this, must see someone that is very...
It did not work in the version we saw.
Well, she was such a minor character. That is an issue with this. Bianca is a bit of a non-entity.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Hortensio has his try, where he gives the musical grammar, and as part of that says who he is and that he wishes to court her. She is not very interested in that.
And then we go on to the next scene, which is the wedding.
This is a very odd scene. They're standing outside the place where they will be married, and they are very angry that Petruchio is late to his own wedding.
Kate storms off in her wedding dress because he didn't show up to his wedding, basically.
She has a great little speech at the very beginning, ending that she will be a mockery in the town. They will say, lo, there is mad Petruchio's wife. If it would please him, come and marry her. This is a very embarrassing thing to happen for your husband not to arrive for your wedding, even if she doesn't particularly want to marry him.
Mm-hmm. And then one of Petruchio's servants comes in and says, oh, they're on their way, and that they are dressed in ridiculous clothes.
Right, this is Biondello, who is probably our goofiest, foolish most character. They ask him when Petruchio will arrive, and he says, when he is here. And you said Petruchio is coming, but now you're saying he's not coming, and his horse is coming, and he is riding his horse. Just stupid silliness.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little fun, and it adds some levity to this odd scene. It's very odd that he would so thoroughly describe the odd clothing of Petruchio.
And Grumio as well, apparently.
And the horse that they're riding.
Yes.
It makes sense that he would describe the odd clothing of a horse, because you might not want to have a horse on stage.
Might poop or something.
Right. And they could just run off and get into the crowd or something. But, The odd thing is that he would describe Petruchio's clothing, because surely we see Petruchio's clothing.
Yeah, he immediately comes on stage right after that.
Right. We know from the ancient history plays, the Julius Caesar, that they don't wear togas, that one of them is wearing a jerkin. But I can't imagine that Petruchio, after this long description of his outfit, is not wearing this outfit.
Right.
Surely he must be wearing it.
It's a very complicated description, and most of the words aren't words anymore, really.
Right. We'll get to a thing later about how our production did it in a much more interesting way.
Basically, he just showed up without pants. Which, you know, did a good job of showing that he's in super embarrassing clothing.
Mm-hmm. Because embarrassing clothing to them means nothing to us.
Right.
It's out of Shakespearean style, but no style in Shakespeare's time is with our style.
Mm-hmm. Tranio offers to lend him some pants or clothes appropriate for a wedding, and Petruchio declares that that Kate is marrying him, not his clothes.
Right, that he will not change clothing for anything. This is establishing Petruchio's claim that he will not be resisted. He's making it clear that he can embarrass his wife, and that nothing she does will change what he does in any way. Her interest is not part of his interest.
Mm-hmm. We get a brief moment where Tranio and Lucentio are alone for a minute, and Tranio basically says, hey, we need to find someone to pretend to be your dad.
Right, because there's more shenanigans that must be done. Gremio, the older courtier, emerges from the church before the wedding is entirely over and says what happens. Basically, it's an odd little bit of staging, because why didn't they just show us what happened?
Mm-hmm.
But it's shocking. I think that this deserves to be read.
Okay.
They wonder if Kate did something wrong, because she's a devil.
Mm-hmm.
And Gremio says, she's a lamb, a dove, a fool to him. I'll tell you, Sir Lucentio, when the priest should ask if Catherine should be his wife, aye, by God's wounds, quoth he, that is, by God's wounds, you know, swearing in a marriage, and swore so loud that all amazed, the priest let fall the book, and as he stooped again to take it up, the mad-brained bridegroom took him with such a cuff that down fell priest and book and priest. Now take them up, if any list. So the priest went to pick up the book, and he just smacked him in the face, knocking him down.
Mm-hmm.
Just shocking. And he tells the rest of this story. Before the end of the wedding, he takes liquor, drinks some of it, sprays it in the face of one of the officials, and covered with liquor, kissed the bride in the lips with such a clamorous smack that at the parting all the church did echo.
And so he's acting like an ass, basically.
Right. And Gremio had to flee the church for shame. I do wonder which would be better, to see it or to hear that description, because that description is really funny.
Everyone comes out of the church, and Petruchio says that he's not going to stick around for the, you know, the wedding feast, but has to leave immediately.
Right. It won't say why, but says, if you knew why, you would tell me to go and not stay. It's that important.
Mm-hmm. More of his, you know, lying to everybody. But
mm-hmm. This is just to show that he will not be swayed by anyone. Everyone, in fact, asks him to stay. He says, sorry, I cannot. Catherine says, I entreat you. And Petruchio says, I am content. Are you content to stay? I am content you should entreat me to stay, but yet not stay. Entreat me how you can.
Mm-hmm. And then she says that he can leave, but she's staying, and then he...
That the party will continue.
And then he acts like everyone is trying to kidnap her.
Well, he makes that argument. He says, my wife is my property. You will come with me. In a performance that we saw, he seizes her by the hair.
Yeah.
Which is kind of this shocking moment that really puts the point to the fact that he is saying, I own her, she is coming with me.
Yeah, our version really played up all the abuse in it.
The cruelty of
it. Yeah.
He even says, Grumio, draw forth thy weapon. We are beset with thieves. Rescue thy mistress. If thou be a man, fear not, sweet wench. They shall not touch thee, Kate. I'll buckler thee against a million. So he actually offers to fight them.
Mm-hmm.
This can be played for comedy, but I don't think it is.
If it were played for comedy, this would be pretty funny.
Unless...
It's basically two crazy people just got married.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, a crazy person is horribly mistreating this woman.
They actually treat it as something that's simply outrageous, not something shocking.
And they all go off laughing, like, right. Oh man, those guys.
They even say, winch they not quickly, I should die with laughing. They even have a little joke, she's madly mated, I'll warrant him, Petruchio is cated. Like, someone's being very witty about it, this shocking scene of abuse.
You know, if you play it up right, it is funny. Mm-hmm. The version we saw did not play it up to be funny. They played it up to be awful.
Right. This leads us to Petruchio's house or his estate or whatever, where Grumio, Petruchio's servant, yells at all the other servants, "Why is this place such a mess? We need fire. I'm frozen and we've been marching all this way. We've lost our horses."
Mm-hmm. Catherine's horse fell, and instead of rescuing her, Petruchio just started beating Grumio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he always acts as though he cares for Catherine, but does so in a way that makes Catherine's situation worse.
Mm-hmm.
We get this impression that they've had a terrible trip. They are cold and they are tired and they've been marching all this time. And she's fallen off a horse, so she's in somewhat worse condition just from that. Yeah, so the horses ran away, so they had to walk the rest of the way. When Petruchio and Kate arrive, Petruchio really becomes a true jerk when he insists that they have food, but when the food arrives, says, "This is burnt."
And throws it on the floor.
Tosses it all away, will not let her eat anything.
And he's running around beating all the servants.
Mm-hmm. And then we come to Petruchio laying out kind of stage two of his plan, which he's already begun. Our special guest speaker guy has offered to record this one, so we'll just kind of insert this here.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, he's saying, "I will not allow her to eat or sleep or have any comfort until she has learned to be obedient."
And he's saying basically he's going to... "Oh, this bed isn't good enough for you, you can't sleep in it. Oh, this food isn't good enough for you, you can't eat it." Stuff like that is what
right.
he's going to do.
He even specifically says that he will kill a wife with kindness. He will pretend that she is being treated well, but in fact be monstrously cruel.
Mm-hmm.
"Thus have I politically begun my reign, and 'tis my hope to end successfully. My falcon is now sharp and passing empty, and till she stoop, well, she must not be full gorged, for then she never looks upon her lure. Another way I have to man my haggard is to make her come and know her keeper's call. That is, to watch her as we watch these kites that bait and beat and will not be obedient. She eat no meat today, nor none shall eat. Oh, last night she slept not, nor tonight she shall not. As with the meat, some undeserved fault I'll find about the making of the bed. Yeah, and here I'll fling the pillow, there the bolster. This way the coverlet, another way the sheets. Aye, aye, aye. And amid this hurdy, I intend that all is done in reverent care of her. And in conclusion, she shall watch all night. And if she chance to nod, I'll rail and brawl, and with the clamour keep her still awake. Well, this is a way to kill a wife with kindness, and thus I'll curb her mad and headstrong humour. He that knows better how to tame a shrew, thou let him speak. Tis charity to show."
And then we jump back to Padua, yeah, with the Bianca story.
So this is just much more trivial.
Yeah, Hortensio is now telling Tranio that he found out that Bianca is in love with the real Lucentio.
Yeah, so they've realized that they have lost. Hortensio even says, "Well, this is done. I'm going to go marry a wealthy widow."
Mm-hmm.
As though they were just freely available on the streets.
Well, he knows that she's into him.
He'll have a lusty widow now that shall be wooed and wedded in a day.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where they meet the pedant,
who is the guy they hired to basically act as the fake father.
Right, because they need to have a guarantee that Bianca will receive this money, and that requires the father. And instead of just asking their father, they decide it could be funnier if they had a fake father. So they say to the pedant, "Don't you know that anyone from your city will be murdered, be executed by the state if they find out you're here? You have to pretend to be someone else." And so he's struck by fear and will do whatever they say.
And they're like, "But, you know, for doing that, could you just do this? Since we're helping you out with that, could you help us out with this one little thing?"
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So we, in Act 4, we return to Kate, who is being specifically refused any food.
Mm-hmm.
She says she's been denied sleep, and Grumio says, "Would you care for various kinds of food?" He then immediately says, "Oh, I can't give you that. I'm sorry." And she yells at him and makes him leave.
Petruchio comes in and Hortensio's come to visit.
This is an odd scene where they've got new clothing for the Kate.
Yeah, for Bianca's wedding.
Who presumably has not had a change of clothing At least the performance that we did kind of emphasized
this clothing. She was still in the wedding dress the whole time.
Right. They've emphasized this clothing angle in the theater version that we saw. And she would very much like some adequate clothing that hasn't been on the ground, torn up by the trip, et cetera, et cetera. So this isn't just a matter of embarrassing her in front of clothing makers. This is a matter of depriving her of yet another thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which plays much better on the stage than when you're reading it.
Mm-hmm. The tailor's like, oh, you told me this. And Patricia's like, no, no, I didn't. On the sly, he has Hortensio to go make sure that the tailor actually does get paid, though.
Right. He insisted all of this is out of style and this is terrible clothing, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. But it's just another matter of him pretending to care for Kate but actually being mm-hmm. cruel for her.
And then it gets crazier because he says that they'll go to her father's house in the clothes they're in, and then starts insisting that it's 7 o'clock in the morning when it's clearly 2 in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm. He does have a good speech about, we'll be going in these mean clothings. I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's rather long. But at the end he says, bring our horses unto Long Lane End. There will we mount, and thither walk on foot. So we're going back to Padua proper, but before we can even get to our horses, we've got to go down Long Lane, which is presumably a long walk.
Yes.
And as you say, he insists that it's 7 o'clock. She says it's 2. And this is the kind of third step of his agenda where reality itself mm-hmm. must answer to him and not her. So when she disagrees, he says that we will leave at 7 or we will not leave. This is 7 now or you're in trouble.
And then we jump back to Bianca's story.
And this is just some goofiness, really. We've got the pedants disguised as the father.
Mm-hmm.
They plan on having a secret wedding, just to not make any trouble, I think.
Right, because why not have this play be more complicated?
That's probably the most important reason.
Everyone's getting set up to explain that the scam is about to happen.
And that brings us back to Petruchio again.
Mm-hmm. And they're on their way, and during the day, and Petruchio's talking about how bright the moon is now.
Right. He says he's never seen the moon so bright. Catherine, of course, insists that it is the sun because it is. And he says, in that case, we're going back home.
Mm-hmm.
We're just going to have to march the rest of the way, all the way back to my terrible place in the cold and with bad provisions mm-hmm. and badly dressed. And she says, whatever you say. If you say it's the moon, fine, it's the moon. He says, what are you, stupid? It's the sun. And then insists that this man that they meet is a woman. And mm-hmm. she, having learned her lesson, as it were, goes along with it, saying, oh, I guess she is a beautiful woman, as you say. It turns out that this man that they meet is the real Vincentio, the real father
of Lucentio.
Right, who is coming to find out how his son is doing, which will make comic antics later. This is where we get the most comic scene, where the real Vincentio comes to the house mm-hmm. and says, I am Vincentio, let me in. And the fake Vincentio from the balcony says, what are you doing here? I'm Vincentio. Lucentio is my son, if my wife tells me true.
Mm-hmm.
He's become rather arrogant in his false Vincentio character.
Yeah. He comes across Tranio and suddenly freaks out because he assumes Tranio, who's disguised as Vincentio.
Right, wearing his clothing.
Because he assumes Tranio has murdered his son and taken his role.
Right, which theoretically could happen. There's no photography or anything. So if you mm-hmm. came up into town dressed as a wealthy guy and you've got the right names to drop, you could simply say, I am this man,
mm-hmm.
because that's what he did.
Yeah.
And kind of live his life at least for a while. So he's devastated, asking, how did you murder my son? What's going on here?
Tranio insists that Baptista arrest Vincentio for being a con man.
Right. This is kind of the ultimate turnaround of this play. We've been talking about how they kind of reverse roles. Not mm-hmm. only is the servant become a lord, but he's arresting his lord's father.
Mm-hmm. As he's about to be arrested, the newly married Lucentio and Bianca come in and reveal everything.
Right. It's all been a big goof.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Petruchio and Catherine are also arrived.
And the servants and the pedant run away.
Petruchio has one last bit of torture.
Husband, let's follow to see the end of this ado.
First kiss me, Kate, and we will.
What, in the midst of the street?
What, art thou ashamed of me?
No, sir, God forbid, but ashamed to kiss.
Why, then let's go home again. Come, sirrah, let's away.
Nay, I will give thee a kiss. Now pray thee, love, stay.
even on this minor point, they've already arrived. He's willing to go all the way home.
Mm-hmm.
So she just kind of goes with it because it's the only option she has.
And then the final scene, everyone is here, including the people who just ran away. So now everyone's here. They're having a big old feast for all three weddings, Kate and Petruchio, Lucentio and Bianca, and then Hortensio and his widow.
Yeah, who doesn't get a name, is simply a widow.
Mm-hmm.
We get a little bit of a back and forth, one of those wit contests that Shakespeare likes and seems to be kind of a thing at the time, where someone says, I'm going to prove this and you're going to try to prove the counter and we'll see who's cleverer. But the women leave before they can really resolve it. And they come upon a clever little bet where Petruchio says, I will wager a ton of money that my wife is in fact the one who is most truly a loyal, true wife. And they, only having seen her as a shrew, of course are willing to wager against that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they all send their servants to go and fetch their wives.
Mm-hmm. And then the first two wives say, oh, I can't come, I'm too busy, or something like that.
Yeah, the first one says, I'm doing something. The second one says, completely outrageously, nay, come you here, which is insane, apparently. Petruchio says that will not stand.
Mm-hmm.
But when Kate is summoned, she comes immediately, and in fact, will even go fetch the other two wives.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a speech essentially saying women are properly subdued to men.
Mm-hmm.
It's very long, so I'm not going to read it all. This is kind of the center point of the meaning of this play and arguments,
whether or not this is a sarcastic speech or a legitimate speech, basically.
Right. The arguments over this kind of define what you think of what the play means.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you can put it on whichever way you want.
I think it's very hard to say this is anything but an anti-feminist speech, and that it pretty clearly says that women should be subdominant to their husbands.
They should love their husbands because their husbands do so much to protect them, basically.
Right, and that they are properly the sovereign of the house. The only thing that I could see as really being sarcastic is when she says that while your husband is off doing painful labor by sea and by land to watch the night in storms, the day in cold, while thou liest warm at home, secure and safe. Because obviously she has not been warm at home, secure and safe.
Right, she's been, you know, it's pretty horrible.
Right, she's been, let's face it, tortured in any modern definition of the word. So that could be delivered sarcastically. If that were a significant fraction of the speech, I could see how that would work. But unfortunately, it is not. It is a reasoned argument that says that women, for example, are bound to serve, love, and obey, that our bodies are soft and weak and smooth, and that we're simply not designed to be these forward people that, you know, kind of make decisions for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, this thought is abhorrent, but at the time, this was simply an argument that was made in all seriousness, I think.
Yep. They agree that Petruchio won the bet and gets even more money.
Right. No one says how awful. They say, thou hast tamed a cursed shrew.
They kiss again.
Kiss me, Kate.
And that's the end of the play. And then in the version we saw, they added the little finale with Christopher Sly waking up from his fake drunken delusion thing.
Right, and the woman who had played Kate. Oh, an interesting thing about the version that we saw is that Petruchio is played by Christopher Sly.
Not only is it the same actor, but it's like they have actually pulled him into the play.
It's an odd little kind of double thing. Because he's been Petruchio all this time, we get the feeling that he thinks as a Petruchio. And in a completely non-Shakespearean line at the end, where the person who has been playing Kate says, it's just a play. As though to say to us, hey guys, think this is just a play.
Mm-hmm. A lot of different ways to look at it.
Right. I think that we've made it pretty clear that we don't think...
we are opposed to abuse in relationships in general, and even out of relationships generally.
Mm-hmm. Things that in a military context would be seen as torture... of, like, prisoners of war is not allowed, and this is on someone that you've just married. It's monstrous, and we're pretty clear that we think that this is simply anti-woman.
Yeah. You can portray this as a fun comedy play, too.
It's been done.
Yeah.
It requires editing, but it's been done.
Editing, a little bit of editing, and just doing it on scene, make everyone act sillier, act more fun. In the version we saw, everyone was acting as horribly as possible, basically. Petruchio was a monster, and even the people on stage seemed to know it.
there's another interesting question as to whether Shakespeare believed all this. I don't think so. The person who made who wrote Cleopatra and Juliet and all these other female characters, he's had more good male characters than female characters, but still, if he believed that a true woman was purely subservient, he would not have been able to write his other plot. And this is just from another person's plot. He didn't write the plot. He's using it as a vaulting place to write some good writing.
Yeah, and apparently, like, I was reading, someone else wrote a play, like, not too long after this.
Yeah.
Which was basically a sort of fan fiction sequel, where Kate dies, and then another woman comes along who has to tame Petruchio.
Really? I've never heard of this.
Neither have I, but it was mentioned on one of the things I was reading about this.
Well, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily, like, even everyone at this time believed as the play presents.
Right. I think that it's certainly a reflection of the modern values, but it's not as though people believe every word of the play.
Right. The version we saw was really, really amped up the whole terrible aspects of it.
Right.
But there are a lot of versions out there that amp up the funny aspects. There's a version out there with John Cleese as Petruchio, and that can't help but be awesome.
Let's talk about the one that we saw.
Okay.
We went down to the local theater, the Guthrie.
Yep.
And it was set with modern dress, because everything has to be with modern dress nowadays.
It makes more sense.
The company that put it on, The Propeller... I don't know why it's called that, but it actually is a good name because they keep things propelled. They are very active. They have a lot of physical business going on that isn't necessarily in the text, but they've got people running from corner to corner and up and down and threatening to hit each other and stuff, and it keeps things going.
It was also an all-male production, which is interesting.
Oh, yes, it was fun to see the all-male production. Bianca and Catherine were played by, if not feminine, then lady-ish men, and they were dressed up in such a way that it worked. They were just kind of, you could think that they were mannish looking women, but the widow, who we never really see much of, is this enormous man with this enormous forehead that was humorously unfeminine.
Though I would say, like, watching the play, I never thought, oh, Bianca is a woman. I was always like, oh, Bianca's a man in a dress. But with Kate, I was like, I got the feeling it was a female character as opposed to a man in a female's role.
Right, their Kate was great.
Yeah.
They did a very good job. I think that part of the Bianca problem is that Bianca isn't much of a character. She's more of a prize than a person. One thing that we should talk about is, as you say, Petruchio's wedding clothes, instead of being the weird Shakespearean clothing that is described, was a brown leather jacket with frills and no pants and some kind of underwear thing to hide his crotch. But if he lifted his arms, which lifted up his jacket, and turned away, we could see his butt.
Yeah.
Which I think a lot of you might think...
It was pretty funny.
We're Shakespeare,
the first time.
We're Shakespeare purists, so we don't approve of that. But on the contrary, I think that it was a very good rendition of this has got to be something that's utterly outrageous and embarrassing. And that's what it did. It worked perfectly. The crowd thought it was far funnier than was warranted. And in fact, they thought many things were funnier than they were warranted. I think it's because people, when they're watching a Shakespeare play, they kind of think, oh man, am I going to get what's going on? So when they do get anything that's going on, there's kind of a release of tension.
We were also in the giggle section, apparently.
Yes, the audience around us was particularly bad.
But you know, you gotta accept that when you're seeing something, people are gonna laugh. And
right.
If you're the only one not laughing, maybe the problem is you.
Yeah, we shouldn't be too dour about it. Yeah, I fully approve of their butt production.
I think part of the problem is with Taming of the Shrew, the first time you see it, you're going to see it as either a subversion of the play where it's all sarcastic and funny, or a completely taking it seriously and it's portrayed as this is awful.
Right.
And unfortunately, I don't know if I could see a funny version of the play and quite get it as much as I would like to.
Right. I actually saw
the 1967 Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton version
production.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Elizabeth Taylor
is amazing in this play, as in addition to everything else she does, and Richard Burton is good, but the movie is a complete betrayal of the play. You know all those things that we were talking about, her being abused? They basically cut all of them out. In particular, she kind of gets to a position where she can live with him. When they get to his house, she is allowed to sleep, and once she wakes up, she kind of says, okay, I'll just be a loyal wife. and she kind of takes over the household and says, let's clean this place up, and makes it all nice. And from then on out, they have a good relationship. So they miss the entire bit where he actually converts her into being...
So they took out all the awful bits and just made it an actual, you know, thing you can enjoy without feeling uncomfortable.
Right. At the beginning of the play, I was feeling bad.
I was like, oh man, Elizabeth Taylor.
So great. Like, you can see the fire in her eyes when she objects, and it's going to be horrible to see her reduced into nothingness. And they just didn't really do that. It's much nicer, and all the sharp edges are taken off. Even though he specifically says, we won't have nice clothing... She has 3 costume changes after that, even though it's all in one day, I think. And by the end, by the actual party scene, she is the Queen of the Nile. She has this tiara and this golden dress. Like, they completely forget what happens in the play.
If you want a modern adaptation rather than a straight version of the play, there's 10 Things I Hate About You with Heath Ledger and... Julia Stiles.
To be honest, I have not seen this movie.
I have. It's like the one romantic comedy I've seen that I can tolerate.
Is there monstrous abuse?
No.
So it misses the point, too.
No, it's basically... It follows more of the framework of the Bianca thing.
So he tutors her.
Yes. The Petruchio character is still hired to woo Kate, but he actually woos her and then falls in love with her.
Mm.
And rather than it being a... and then there's the standard romantic comedy thing where she finds out that he was hired to woo her and pissed off at him.
They have a brief.
Yeah.
And then he holds a boombox outside her house.
No, he actually took all the money he got and bought her a guitar.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, sorry.
Anyway, so it's more of a bullet point version than an actual...
It's a much better version with the humor in it.
I mean, it's just sort of, they took the broad themes.
Yes, it's set in high school, and there's also, a small Shakespeare subplot with a couple of the minor characters.
Anyway, this has been seen all over the place by reviewers and people trying to figure out how good this play is and what this play means. Basically, any sort of pro-feminist or anti-feminist position has been taken.
Mm-hmm.
And any sort of position along the lines of, it's a truly great play, which I think it might be, to all the way to, it's a monstrous play that doesn't really work.
Like, with all things, you know, you gotta have a personal view on this.
Yeah.
And if you don't like it personally, then even if it's good, you can't enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's sort of my position, exactly. It's a well-written piece of monstrosity.
Except for that induction, which is just...
Right.
Dumb.
Like I said earlier, I don't think that this is the real thing. I think that the copy that we have is not complete.
Mm-hmm.
But the poetry is good. The dialogue is strong. Kate's character is much stronger than is warranted by the play. There's no reason that she should be so eloquent and so strong, at least at first, other than Shakespeare's true ability to make people real. And it's almost worse because she's such a real person.
You don't want the bad things to happen to her.
Yeah, so your thoughts?
I think I would like to see a comedy version of it, but I think I'd have to let this version cool down a while yet. Because, I mean, dang. I don't usually get angry during plays, but, I mean, it was just like a, wow, this is making me... It was very uncomfortable, let's say.
Definitely. Yeah, they played up the monstrousness of the performance. Okay, so we do have a small bit of news. This has been going around, even though it's not really news.
Or even interesting.
Right. These two people released a paper that basically said Shakespeare was this canny, money-grubbing guy who was prosecuted for criminally hoarding grain, which we've known about for a long time. The documentation that says that Shakespeare was fined for this is old. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of any significant changes to that historical thing. The only thing that I think is interesting about it is Shakespeare lived and worked mostly in London. We can infer from the fact that that's where he did his job, his acting job.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe what we're seeing here is evidence of his wife Anne Hathaway's speculation. Mm-hmm. She would have been the household manager, as it were, and so she would have been the one who would buy the grain and try to sell it for a profit later. I mean, if I was married to someone who lived in London and had his job writing plays, I might want to kind of set aside some money.
Because, you know, those playwrights do not always work out.
Yeah, he became a very successful playwright, but I wouldn't blame her for thinking I should probably set some money aside.
Especially if it was earlier on in his career.
Yeah, we really don't know anything about their personal life, so, I mean, what can we say?
Shakespeare liked money.
I like to think that it's something that Anne Hathaway was up to.
Okay.
Anyway, as always, you can go to iTunes and give us a good rating there if you want other people to find it. You can leave us comments at bardcast.blogspot.com. We had some people who mentioned that they really like Taming of the Shrew in anticipation of this.
In fact, we even got someone who said that this is their favorite Shakespeare play. Jordy Girl says that there are many reasons that she loves Taming. The main reason has to be the absurd craziness that goes on in the play. She thinks that the ending is debatable and that it's possible that Kate is being sarcastic. But what she really enjoys is the shenanigans, as she puts it. And she says that Bianca's suitors go through all sorts of nonsense to woo her. I don't know which characters to feel sorry for. Then there is the matter of it being a play within a play. It is overall a fun story. And she points out that it's good to watch different versions of the same play, which I definitely agree with. It really gives you a sort of different perspective to see it more than once and through different people's eyes. Dodgy Cupcake also agrees about the meta theater, the theater within the theater, which I also enjoy. And she specifically says that she does believe that the Kate speech is sarcastic. As she points out, and I agree, all of Shakespeare's lines can be delivered in different ways, which changes their meaning. Personally, I don't think that it's sarcastic, but it's definitely up to the performance that decides what it is. Oh, she also suggests 10 Things I Hate About You.
We didn't get much response to Shakespeare's histories, and I realized why. Nobody cares. Nobody cares about the classification of Shakespeare's histories. Maybe someone writing a paper later might say, why is this a history and this one not? But anyway,
feel free to cite us.
Why don't we just do something where people care? So I'm going to drop a bomb. I'm going to have a vote on the website. It'll say, do you want Coriolanus, which a lot of people have been asking for, or do you want Hamlet? And then we're going to do whichever one people vote for. The end. So, big deal. If you want Hamlet, here's your chance. I know people have said that they've expected us to do it. So
here's your chance. We did that little Hamlet thing a while ago.
Yeah, we can't take Hamlet all at once.
Well, we could.
We can't do it in one episode. Because we just don't have the time in a day. Yeah, we will, if you guys prefer Hamlet, we will just do Hamlet in as many episodes as it takes before we go to another thing. I think that's exciting. Anyway, that's it for the episode proper. Just one last message out there.
Wait a minute, is this, what are you doing?
I am asking for a job.
First things first, I'd like to give a big, big thank you to everyone who's given us a donation in the past. It's really great that you guys do that, and I always feel a little guilty when we get it because we're just a couple of idiots putting on a show. We don't really deserve it. But anyway, it does help us with the entire expenses of going to the theater and getting microphones. This episode sounds a little different than the previous ones because we're trying out a new microphone. The next episode should sound a lot better from what we're doing. I'll leave it to you to decide whether that's the case. But I'm not asking for a donation this time. I'm actually asking for work. I am currently employed, but the job that I have is definitely below my capabilities. If someone out there needs someone that is intelligent and can work hard, both physically and intellectually, is creative, can write and read well, who can communicate, who can work with other people in an office environment, in a more working environment, I'm very available. I have a computer science and a history degree. I can produce a resume and references upon request, and I'm able to travel anywhere in the world, and I only require a living wage, advancement potential, or a chance to use my brain. You can send an email to bardjob@gmail.com. That's bardjob@gmail.com, or you can go to the blog, bardcast.blogspot.com, and send a message, and I'll get in contact with you. Also, if anyone needs a paper revised, any sort of essay looked at, I can provide that as sort of a freelance thing, or if they need some sort of brainstorming, I can do that as a freelance thing, just on a case-by-case basis. Just send an email to bardjob@gmail.com, and we will see you next time with either Coriolanus or Hamlet. Thanks for listening.